Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Good evening.
You're listening to Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. We thank you for tuning in and hope you enjoy another exciting episode of our show.
All right, folks, we're in the middle of another great show, having some great conversations with some amazing people, and definitely enjoying a lot of amazing things going on. As a matter of fact, we just finished doing a Black Business Expo, and of course, that was a very powerful event, and we're definitely looking forward to having some more great conversations with truly amazing people. So always have some great conversations going on in our world, and of course, people are paying attention to a number of things that are happening in society. So we know a lot of folks are paying attention and definitely seeing a lot of things that are going on in the world and trying to figure out their role in what that is and how they can play whatever that role may be. So, like I said, whether it's the things going on with the coronavirus, whether it's things going on with a number of other things in society, there are a lot of things that people are concerned about. We know people have been paying attention to the forest fires, paying attention to that is going on in California and a number of other places around on the West Coast. And, of course, we know that New Orleans was just recently devastated as well with things that they had happening in their world. So definitely that is some of the things that are happening as well. So definitely we have a lot of great conversations going on in that regard. So I know a lot of people are very much concerned about things that are happening in their world and things that are going on where they are as well. So definitely these are some truly amazing times. We're glad to have one of our guests joining us as well. So definitely I'm going to bring him on and see what some of his conversation is all about and what's going on in his world. But a lot of folks have been paying attention to a number of things. And, of course, we're glad to have folks enjoying what we have happening here as well. So definitely we want folks to tune in, learn what's happening, and see what's happening in that world. So definitely some truly amazing conversations, and a lot of people are paying attention to that. Yes, we're definitely seeing a lot of people. Yep. So a lot of great conversations taking place, and we're going to bring up our guests. I think that we've got a doorbell that says that somebody has joined us, so we're going to see who we've got in the house. So definitely I'm going to unmute, and we're going to see who we've got in the house and all of that. So welcome, folks. Who do we have in the house here in the studio with us, and can you share a little bit about yourself?
I'm right here, IPC. IPC.
Hey, IPC. I'm glad IPC is in the house. How are you doing, IPC? IPC is a truly amazing poet. Glad to have IPC in the house with me. He does some great things and some amazing things in our community, but I would love to hear from you what you've got going on and what's happening in your world. IPC, we met when I decided to join the wonderful world of Clubhouse because I did not know about Clubhouse and heard people talking about this great app, but then I found that it was only for iPhone users, and I unfortunately am an Android person, so I was going like, well, it ain't for me. But then y'all changed the rules and let Android people in there, and then I discovered this great creative community. I was up late last night talking to you and Consuela and all of these amazing folks and everything, and we were standing up listening to cello music and listening to poetry and everything else. So share with us a little bit about how you got involved, and you have this rich history too. Like when I read that this is a man that performed with and did work with George Lucas, I'm like, wow, I've met somebody that knows George Lucas and worked with this man, and I definitely was a Star Wars fan and a fan of a lot of the other great science fiction that came out of that universe. So just share a little bit with our audience a little bit about who IPC is.
I go by IPC, and that stands for I Paint Creatures, and that's basically my artist brand. I'm a full-time professional creative. I'm a multidisciplined artist. I love making music. I play several instruments, and I'm a vocalist and a rapper and a scatter, and I also love to paint and draw fantastical worlds from my imagination. I'm a visual storyteller, and I love to perform spoken word poetry. I'm an award-winning spoken word poet and an oral storyteller. And over in the fantasy world and the creature world, I specialize in Japanese yokai, which are basically Japanese folklore creatures. And I've had the grand opportunity to work for such luminaries as the incredible George Lucas, creator of Indiana Jones and Star Wars. And I've also had the opportunity to work up in Redmond, Washington with some of the forward thinkers with Bill Gates, Ting at Microsoft. And I got the grand opportunity to also work in the Knowledge Navigator and the Futuristic Division of Apple Computers when the late, great Steve Jobs was still around. And what I did with a lot of those companies is brought visual storytelling and tested a lot of their hardware and basically prepared for the future that we're living now. And I get on Clubhouse because, you know, I'm an independent artist, so I was just putting my brand out there and put out a book 2 years ago that was crowdsourced funded that has all my art and stories and poems and sketches and working on a huge epic tale just like Harry Potter or Star Wars or Lord of the Rings that is called Matsu. So I landed on Clubhouse because they said I am an Apple user because I'm from California and all the creative divisions of like Lucasfilm and of course worked at Apple, so I fell in love with their product line to be very creative. And so one day I heard on YouTube some guys saying Clubhouse. I'm like, what is that? And basically Googled it and found it was an audio app. And at first I thought it was a joke because I was like, man, we're going retro. Like, we can do full video in HD and 4D. So, like, why are we going backwards? And then the article on Google said it's not open to everyone. You have to be invited. But definitely they recommend go over there if you have a brand and make sure, you know, someone doesn't take your name. And I've been doing I Paint Creatures for probably like about 6 years now. So I headed over there to make sure no one took I Paint Creatures. And I signed up, and then within like 5 minutes, an old poetry colleague of mine contacted me and says, you're in. So I landed in this thing, and I was like, what are you doing here? And the first thing I saw was a poetry house. And so I wandered in the poetry house and trying to figure out what was going on, and they're like, whoa, we read in your bio you're a poet. Will you spit a poem? So I spit a poem, and I think I got like maybe like close to 45 followers. So I was like, wow, this is kind of home. So that's my story of Clubhouse.
Well, that's a fascinating story and definitely one that I can resonate with and relate to. But, yeah, they seem to be a great platform. Like I said, I've met all kinds of creatives there, whether they're hairdressers or artists or definitely people that are doing a variety of ways of even getting their brand out there. I was not sure how I'm still not sure how I feel about the whole follow kind of mentality that goes on in Clubhouse where you're building your follows by doing that whole rules of engagement kind of methodology, which I understand. But sometimes I'm going like, is it really building my brand? Is it really not building my brand? So I'm still trying to put out the jury on that and everything, but I definitely love the Clubhouse space and think it's truly amazing. It's interesting, you talked about it being retro IPC, and the first time I started telling people about Clubhouse, it reminded me, and I'm in that late 50s category, it reminded me of the old party lines because, you know, growing up in like the 70s and everything, and definitely having, I know in New York there was the Village Voice, and here we have a magazine called The Independent, and you would see like those old phone lines where people would call, and it would be people that would just be having the phone lines before the internet kind of really took off the way it has. So when the Clubhouse app came, I'm like, isn't this just party lines reinvented? But, you know, they say all great adventures just wind up getting reinvented.
Yeah, well, one magical thing happened. I realized when my one buddy brought me on there, he was saying, you know, the bio is your key. And I'm like, what? And, you know, my background is my family was in the Japanese internment camp. So I was kind of raised, you know, without sharing my culture because they were in fear that it would happen again. And the story of the Clubhouse is the first time I found myself using my bio to the full extent, and it actually worked. So it was a bit, kind of a healing experience.
Yep, and you talk about your heritage. I don't know if you've ever met this young poet by the name of G. Yamaskazi, I think is the last name, but he's a young poet from here in North Carolina, but he's originally from, he's traveled around, so I know he spent some time in the L.A. area, along with Kane Smago and others, but he's known me for a while. As a matter of fact, I remember when he was a young high school kid just getting into the spoken word community. So sometimes when he comes back to the Cultural Arts Center that I'm part of, he'll be like, yeah, there's Uncle Mark, or they definitely give me respect as an elder and all of that, because when we held the national competition in Durham, he was actually, you know, going around doing drinking and other things that you're not supposed to be doing it as a teenager. But the adults recognized his talent, recognized what he was about, and let him get away with things that we probably were not supposed to let him get away with, but we still let him get away with it, and he's definitely blowing up on that national scene. So it does sound like you do know the gentleman that I'm talking about.
Yep, I know George very well, and I actually have mentored him.
Okay, cool. Yeah, George is fantastic.
You know,
like I said,
you know Dasan then.
I know Dasan very well. Dasan and me are like very good peers. Dasan runs the Haytai Poetry Slam, and I actually work for Haytai. So I've known Dasan for years, know a lot of those crew. So I know Dasan, know Church the Poet, know the gentleman out of New York and that whole crew. And I'm actually good friend with Garland Thompson Jr., who I know represents that California area with kind of that beatnik poetry scene that he brings out, with kind of like beatnik beats African-American poetry that he's been doing for years, because his dad was a leading proponent of black theater before he passed away at the National Black Theater Festival, and I actually helped organize one of the memorials for him. So, yeah, I know we probably have a lot of common friends.
Yeah, I've featured at the Bull City Slam, and I've toured through your area many times in Winston-Salem and Charlotte and Asheville.
Yeah, there's some great poetry come out of there. Like Kelly Ray has done some amazing work. Definitely a number of the other works have done some great things, like Trent, Petrina, and a number of other great poets that are here, Kimberly, and a number of other amazing ones. So I'm sure that if we ran across, we'd probably be like, oh, yeah, I know who you are. I know you by face and by voice. So we know we recognize each other by voice all the time. But even when I was hearing the voice, I was like, I think I've met this man before. So it does not surprise me that we've traveled in some of those same circles and all of that.
And I'm proud to say, when I used to tour it's been a while, you know, especially before the pandemic. I basically would always go to all these venues, and I'm a two-time world head-to-head haiku champion, so I would always call out for them to send their best haikuster, well, that's what I call them, haiku poet, up to battle me, and I'm proud to say I'm undefeated in all of the Carolinas. They've never beaten me.
Wait a minute. So you meant that Leonard Moore, who was supposed to be one of our masters at haiku, took you on and he went down? Are you trying to tell me that one of our master haiku artists went down? Because I know that Leonard is supposed to be considered one of our top haiku artists here in the Carolinas.
Took them all down. They never beat me. And I'm undefeated in New York City, too.
Wow, undefeated in Durham, undefeated in the Carolinas. Now, when you say the Carolinas, you're saying that you're undefeated in both North and South Carolina.
Yeah, because I won my second world head-to-head haiku title in Greenville.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you're just totally undefeated. Now, what about some of the more stronger areas of poetry? You know, New York's got a strong poetry community. D.C.'s got a strong poetry community. I know California does, too. I've mentioned Garland Thompson Jr., and definitely Texas does as well. So are you undefeated in some of those stronger cities as well, or some of the stronger states? Or will you admit that you've gone down in some other places?
I'm undefeated in all 50 states.
Wow. He is undefeated in all 50.
Yeah.
Nobody can take the man down.
New York City, I featured. Are you familiar with the New Yorkian Poets Cafe?
I'm very familiar with them. For me, it was one of the events I went to was with Rome Neal, and Rome Neal does the banana poetry thing, and I know that I was actually sharing with a friend of mine that I met in Clubhouse the poem that we created like some 10 or 12 years ago, because he always does that banana poetry jam that he does, and he actually had us all create a collaborative piece. And I do not claim to be a poet. Dasan will tell you I don't claim to be a poet, but I do write on occasional prose and write some occasional things. So I stuck my prose in the middle of all of that poetry. So my prose is stuck in the middle of that whole long piece that was created, I want to say, maybe 13, 14, 15 years ago.
Yeah, well, in the New Rican, I'm proud to say they didn't even send anyone up.
Oh, they didn't even bother to try to take you down. They were like, we can't beat this man.
I was like, New York City, and I'm like, bring him on up. And then just I sat there for like 5 minutes. And no, they didn't send anyone. So I announced on the mic, I guess I'm undefeated in New York City. I was surprised.
You were surprised that nobody tried to take you down at all. I'm surprised as well. Gene, who is usually here with me, but I know he's doing some work with his compadre in terms of his work because he works with corrections, and he works in the correction field of New Jersey. So as he's nearing closer to retirement, I think he's in his, well, he's younger than me, but he's probably like late 40s, early 50s. But I know that he has been, when you're near retirement, then they start giving you crazy work hours. So even though we do our show on Monday, he did tell me that to last week and this week, I might have to handle it on my own with my guests and everything. I was like, no problem. I can do that. I came up in the world of radio, so this is nothing new for me, and I can definitely handle it. But that being said, he is part of the street team for somebody else that you probably are familiar with as well, because you are a student not just of poetry, but of hip-hop. And I'm so sure that you've heard of Ninth Wonder and his whole tribe. Well, Dean is part of that squad that goes out there and handles the promotion. So they have a whole squad that handles the promotion, and Dean is a part of that squad. And we actually connected through a mutual friend of ours that was involved in fashion and poetry as well as radio by the name of Ty Jones. So she was doing this show that had her title in it and all of that, but then she decided to go pursue life, marriage, and just other things and left without anybody else pursuing it. And the team was like, well, we're enjoying it, so let's keep it going. So we kept it going. Later on, she tried to come back into the fold, and we were like, it's a whole other kind of show now. And she's like, oh, well, I'll go do mine. Y'all do yours. So we left on those kind of terms, but we definitely have kept our thing rolling. And I think she still got her thing rolling as well, even though she's been going through some life issues. So a lot of her stuff is focused around some of those life issues, like around cancer survival and other things. But we're glad to be part of that community with her, and I'm sure that she's glad to be part of our community as well. But it's just always fascinating seeing these connections and knowing these connections. As a youngster and being somebody that was having this Japanese background, did you always think you were going to be a creative? Because, I mean, you're very involved in the creative world, the filmmaking world, the Microsoft world, these different other worlds. Did you always think that this was going to be something you were going to pursue?
Well, that's kind of a long-winged question because I basically lost my father to stomach cancer when I was 10 years old. And so I basically started hanging around the hospitals. And then after I lost him, the next year I was in a Cub Scout play because my mom was just trying to wrangle me in because I was always super creative, but at first, you know, very disruptive and you know, a real rebel and a street kid, because after my father died, I basically went to the streets in the Bay Area to find family. And I was in a Cub Scout play, and I basically played the strong man, and it kind of bonded me and my mom, because my mom went back to work, like three jobs to hold down after my father left. And so she was actually doing the seamstressing on my costume, and I held my left arm up in front of the mirror, and it basically I said I was a strong man and discovered a tumor on my left arm about the size of a softball. And so I basically went back in the hospital again down in the Palo Alto area, the Stanford area, and I survived that demise because the first doctor said cut off his arm, and he only lived like 3 or 4 years longer. So I'm a person on the internet that tells everyone I'm internally 14 because what the doctor said. So basically my mother found an alternative method, you know, a doctor that was willing to carve it out and carved it out. And they still don't know if it was cancer or what it was, but they got it out of me and they didn't amputate. But that's where basically art started, because I basically was in the waiting rooms, and then the year later after my father passed, you know, being in the hospital. And so I just started drawing and sketching. And since I'm so broken through my family heritage, I didn't know, like, all my ancestors are basically poets and painters and educators. And so I just started doing it. And then a nurse came to me one day and he's like, you know, those are cool little creatures, what you're drawing there. And I thought I was drawing monsters, and I was kind of cut off from all the pop culture, because that's around the age when, you know, you start learning from your friends or want to be like the cool kid. And so I just kind of went in my own world, and I started writing a lot, mainly because I went through this experience that a lot of 11-year-olds don't go through. So I was just like scribbling outside the page, and lo and behold, it was poetry. And then I started relating it, and this one nurse was like, you got to go paint for these kids down the hallway. And I didn't know at the time the kids down the hallway was the terminal section, all the kids that wow. basically had terminal diseases. So I just started doing these creatures, and then, of course, the nurse kept on telling me, he told me all about Dr. Seuss and all these things, and I was like, whatever, whatever. And then as I went in my teenage years, it's the only thing that saved me from getting too heavy into the streets was art. So I was writing, I wasn't sharing it with anyone, but I would draw, and then what that led, of course, is my friends had hip-hop crews and punk bands, and so I started doing flyers. And so, yeah, art basically saved my life. So that's, I guess that would answer what you're saying is I knew I was creative because it was the only thing to keep me out of jail and keep me from killing other people and killing myself.
Yeah, it sounds like art definitely played a very major role in your life and definitely kept you going in a positive direction. And that's very wonderful, the way that art did that for you and definitely kept that creative juices going. One of the things I was wondering is that, and I've had this conversation with a lot of my friends, even some of Desan's been on this show as well, is what do you find the role of art to be in society? Because I know that I've got a good friend that talks about that he really wishes that we were doing more with teaching art in our community. He's actually the founder of the live streaming platform that I'm going to hopefully get you on as well, that's called the International Broadcast Media. But he oftentimes talks about that we're in the 21st century, but our education system is stuck in the 18th century. And he really wishes, because he's got a financial background and a legal background, that we talk more about financial responsibility, but also more about the arts and actually encouraged artists. So I was wondering your thoughts about that. Is one that is worked with some of the leading minds. I mean, you worked with Microsoft and George Lucas, but do you feel that we're actually encouraging our artists enough and our young artists?
Well, actually, it became full circle because it took me 5 high schools to graduate because, you know, I had had that intense experience with my father and myself, so I had already kind of gone out in the world. So, like, them teaching me science and geography when I had a broken heart from a girl wasn't working. And so it went full circle because I eventually came up to Chico, California, where I live up in Northern California, and I did it to kind of escape the streets in the Bay Area, and kind of got fooled by an old family friend into, like, writing grants to get, you know, funded for college, and then kind of got college, and I wasn't in the college, but I was loving all the social life, you know, with the young girls and just meeting all kinds of people, and then gave me outlets through my art. But it eventually led to me one day I got a job in a computer lab because I started getting into technology, and then I wrote this grant because it was just sitting on the desk, and I worked there late night, and one day I just opened this package, and it said, you know, kind of the question you're asking, what role does art have in your life and society? And so I just wrote down a whole bunch of my ideas. At that time, I had a really astute kind of logical roommate. And I left it on the table one night when I came home, and he asked me, what is this? And I said, I don't know, this is a grant thing. And I just wrote down a bunch of my ideas, and he ended up sending it in to IBM, and then I got funded. And so then it paved the way for me to do a master's degree, and then I ended up doing my master's degree with an amazing lady who became my master's chair, and she had a degree in quantum physics and early childhood education with music. And so it was like a weird combination. And so it got me into for the first time I was interested in learning and education, because they said something about, she was all about how people taking information in the world. And I've been going to concerts and hanging out with rock and roll bands and hip-hop crews, so I was just like, whoa, I'm into that. I would like to study how people perceive. I've always wondered what happens at a concert. You know, why did everyone spend all this money and let alone get all messed up on drugs and alcohol to survive in there? Like, what are they doing in here besides the party? And so I studied that. So my degree became, my master thesis is all basically a whole thesis all about that art and technology are not subjects. They're vehicles for learning. So, yeah, so basically to answer your question, art to me is essential to making lifelong learners and basically teach people about who they truly are, their purpose in life. And I'm a strong advocate of educational reform, and I work in projects right now in the schools with kids. And my whole mission in life is to build people's mental faculties back up, you know, their curiosity, their imagination, their wonder, their intuition. And I think, that is the essential part to really change the world back us to being, you know, that's why I love creatures too, like being creatures instead of these, you know, logical war machines that a lot of us have become.
Oh, definitely. That's interesting you say that, because actually my dad is an artist as well. He's a photographer and was definitely involved in civil rights and a number of other things. And, of course, he and my mom founded a community radio station that I oftentimes talk about in those clubhouse profiles and everything. But definitely when they were doing that, a lot of times they were wanting to encourage me, encourage my younger brother to follow our artistic interests, or definitely our creative interests, because I don't know that Malik has necessarily any strong artistic interests that I'm aware of, even though he's a gamer and definitely is involved in that game world as a fan and as a participant, not as a creator of them. But definitely as my nephews were born, and I don't have any kids, but as my nephews were born, I remember that my dad would be showing them things around scientific things, like, you know, what's going on with a worm or the rabbit or the grass and different other things. And I'm sure that some people were probably like thinking to themselves, why is Jim Lee doing this? Because these are young kids and their brains aren't developed enough. They're probably not even getting this. But Dad's attitude was always one to kind of that attitude that people have had about women listening to music when the baby is still in the womb. But I think that's Dad's attitude toward education, was to start teaching them at a very young age, and hopefully it will resonate and develop with them as they grow into the young men that they are soon to become, as they are now preteens. This is their birth month, so they are 12 and 13 and all of that. So August is their birth month, and this is the year that they turn 12 and 13, one being born in 2008 and the other being born in 2009. But what do you say to people when they tell you that they feel that you shouldn't teach young people at a young age or at a very young age? Because I'm actually of the opinion that the earlier the better.
Yeah, well, I'm doing a project right now because I live right below Paradise, California, which was in 2018, the wildflowers wiped out the whole town. And so I'm part of a project right now where Butte County is the county I'm in, and Paradise is in. Butte County Office of Education has gathered up like 19 artists in all different multiple disciplines, and we go into the schools and we work with the kids' trauma, and we do art. So the last project I just finished about a month ago was a residency with first grade. And first graders are like, they're my favorite to work with, you know, because when you start getting older, they start getting the cool. And so the first graders are like so amazing, because a lot of my mission goes back to that professor who had the quantum physics and the early education. She had a really unique way, and I don't know if anyone is familiar with like Howard Gardner's work at Harvard, but Howard Gardner, because in psychology and especially in education, there's a really basically a model that came from the military, how we all are broken down into emotional body, right, physical body, and mental body, right? And so this lady turned me on to this incredible science that she actually ran this place called the International Institute for Education for the Arts. So like for like 4 or 5 summers, I would go up to her retreat place and I'd be one of the counselors. And how she was working with kids, especially a kid that has ADHD or is like, you know, or bigger than the other kids, so he's like a bully, right? And so the base principle is you work with all these kids, and why they're having so many emotional and mental and social problems is because their whole being's out of balance. And so the simple formula she used is basically music tunes their emotions, right? Visual art and poetry tunes their mind. And then, of course, theater and dance, you know, basically tunes their physical. And when you work with them at a early childhood age, you tune their being. So then basically a whole spectrum of the being comes. So you look at it as a being becomes holographic. So you can't look at them with all these mental diseases and all this stuff, because they're a hologram now. You can't tell if they're using their physical or their mental or their emotional to learn or be engaged in what they're doing. So, yeah, that's a lot of my take on it, and I've continued to do that work like crazy in even all my arts, and, you know, it's merged with my work in hip-hop and my work with rock and roll music and all that. Just really started looking at concerts. And that's what, at the highest level, that's why they grace so much money, and they're a big part of people's, you know, realizing their life. And then back to Howard Gardner, if no one knows about Howard Gardner, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's really well known for revolutionizing how you look at education, in the sense that a child is just not mental, emotional, physical. They could have a talent of music. They could be musical, or they could be, you know, all the different areas. And so they actually have a musical intelligence or a painting intelligence.
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely felt that way as well. With coming back to even your love of creatures, I definitely want to come to that as well. Did you always have a love of creatures, or is that something that developed later in life? Because I'm thinking they're going, like, whenever I hear that acronym, it is I Paint Creatures, and that's definitely part of what you've done even in that Hollywood space. But were you one that was always interested in things that were outside of the norm in the sense of being creatures? I know that personally I'm a lover of animals, so I have friends that would tell me that I would literally walk by, see a rabbit, and maybe even have an entire conversation with a rabbit, like, as if I'm almost like Dr. Doolittle, but I just have an affinity for animals, both wild and domesticated. So definitely, even though I don't currently have any pets, some of my neighbors, if I'm going by and I see the cat in the windowsill, I'll probably have a conversation with it. But I was just wondering yourself when this fascination with creatures came around.
Well, it first started in that hospital story again, right, because I was cut off from, you know, the normal kind of 10 to, like, 15 years old, you know, when you really are in school and you see that cool kid liking, you know, LL Cool J or AC/DC or even Star Wars, right? And so you model them. And since my father went in the hospital and then the year after I went in there, I basically got cut off from that whole influence. So I would sit there and draw. And I was always the weird kid of just be like, man, I'd start to draw a dog because I loved animals too, because they were a savior because of how I grew up. You know, my family didn't express themselves about their heritage or anything, so I really connected with animals all the time, like pets and dogs. And so I always loved drawing dogs, but I was that kid who was like, whoa, what if I put elephant ears on it? And what if I gave them horns? You know, and so I started doing that. And then when that nurse discovered me, right, I didn't know, I wasn't that conscious back then, but I basically would go into these hospital rooms with these kids that were terminal, were dying. And so I couldn't draw them a monster, so I would always draw them, like, I'd find a kid that, like, I learned she liked hip-hop, so I'd draw the creature with headphones on, you know, and a big satellite dish coming out of his head, and it was all metaphoric to, like, giving her so she could hear a hip-hop concert from far away. And I would just make these fantastical creatures. And then the wild story is after my surgery, right, I was not into Star Wars or any of that, but they were playing Star Wars in the movie theater in the hospital. And I just demanded, I was still all drugged up, you know, from the surgery, but I demanded them that they roll my bed into the theater. And I don't know why, and then they rolled me in there. Of course, I fell asleep, like, you know, probably like 10 minutes in the movie. But I think that's really strange, because then years later, I got the opportunity to go work at Lucasfilm. And I've never really been a fan of Star Wars, you know, because that incident with going in the hospital, I came out, and all I had my mind on was hustling. You know, like, how do I make a living, you know? And I was more, like, so when I went to Lucasfilm, I was more fan of, like, how do you guys make millions of dollars and do this more than the story, you know?
But you've also now created your own fantastical group as well, because I know that they mentioned in the room yesterday that you've got this puppetry group that's going to be taking off out of Clubhouse, and hopefully it'll be touring once we get out of the mystical world of COVID and everything. But tell us a little bit about that as well, because I was fascinated that you've got some of these people with different voices. Maybe I can lend a voice at some point as well, but I've got folks that have got their own characters.
I think we need you, Mark, we need you. So that basically came out of, you know, I continued to do creatures because, like I said, in high school, started to figure out, whoa, if I do this band flyer for my friend, he'd give me $25 or $30, you know. And I was like, whoa, okay. So I start cranking that out. And, you know, and in that world, you know, the creatures are like, that's the perfect thing to do for a band flyer, and some type of creature, you know, some punk rock creature or... So I always continue to do that, and then I'm just a constant. I've been, ever since the hospital days, I've been a constant sketcher. So I would draw and just always, like, always drawing critters, and that's where, like I said, I wasn't a fan of, like, Charles Schultz or, you know, the Peanuts or Aunt Simpsons or any of that. I was never a fan of it, but I would always want to know who was the guy creating all this and getting paid. And so I started doing creatures like crazy. And then, of course, when I went to Lucasfilm, it really kicked in because that's one of the reasons he hired me. He looked at my sketchbook, my portfolio, and he's like, man, you just draw these creatures that we've never seen ever. And that's where he also defined Lucasfilm. George is very astute on that. You know, there's monsters and there's creatures, and monsters are creatures that got hurt and didn't heal themselves. Right. And so they play a big role in storytelling and visual storytelling, right? And so I went into that world, and I got to work on some really innovative projects because I didn't work for, most people don't know there's LucasArts and then there's Lucasfilm, and Lucasfilm is where I work, and Lucasfilm is George's limited liability corporation. It only has 50 employees. So, like, I didn't work in the film industry production. I actually got to work on George's R&D projects, which are unlimited funding and no deadlines. And so it was like, you know, kind of like dreaming. And the first two projects, I got to work in the universe of Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And one of the things was it was a lot of directed toward kids. And so my creatures fit in like crazy. So I got to invent them there and storytelling. And so that's how I got deep into creatures. And why I moved on to the project I'm working on now is called the Funky Eye Puppets. And why I started to move in that, because after I left Lucasfilm, you know, I had a serious girlfriend, moved in with her, looking like marriage and family, which is far from my artist life, but I was just going with the flow. And then we kind of hit rock bottom money-wise, so I was like, well, I'll go back to Lucasfilm and work for a while. And I actually went in there, and I was about to get some management positions or art directors, you know, so I could actually buy a house and everything and work there. And then my boss from the previous time saw me in the hallway, and before I took the job, she pulled me in her office, and she pretty much moved the stuff off her desk, looked me straight in the eye, and she says, this is off the record. I'm like, what's going on now? And she looked at me, and she says, you can't work here. And I'm like, what? I need to work here. I need a job, and I'm not going to work some stupid job after working here. And she's like, I just need to look into your soul and tell you something. And I looked at her, and she says, you won't survive here, and I need to ask you, the job you're going to take, are you going to stay here? And I was like, you know, she knew me real well, and I couldn't poker face her. And I was like, no, I'm just going to work this until I can get back out. And she said, I know exactly what you're going to do. And I said, what? And she says, we have very few of you come through here. And you came through, and you, especially because you work side by side with George, you showed us that you're a storyteller. And then that tapped into my whole heritage, and I was like, whoa. And she's like, so you won't survive here because you do the high-end level. You know, a lot of people who get jobs here, they do one thing. They're really good at one thing, and they play a part of the team. But you was lucky you got that job with George because he had you writing, he had you drawing, he had you painting, he had you directing. And so basically that's where I got storytelling. And where the Funky Eye Puppets came out is I was touring the country, like that's when I was coming to the Carolinas a lot, and I was making my living as a spoken word poet, right, because I won the championships in my belt so I could get paid really well at universities. And so I was touring, but it put me in the hotel a lot, right? And then, of course, I always carry around my sketchbook. I never let that go, even though I was doing more poetry than painting and drawing. And I'd sketch. And then, of course, my cell phone, I'd start going on YouTube And then I was seeing that these creators that were storytellers were, you know, doing crowdsourcing, getting funded, like $500,000. I'm like, whoa. So basically, the calling happened when my mom was declining, so I had to kind of get off the road, and I was kind of sick of it too anyway, because I kind of bypassed a lot of having booking agents and all that, because I would make more money and have more control of what I was doing. But then it was burning me out. So I went home to take care of my mother, and then, you know, I would watch YouTube like crazy, and at one point I discovered this artist, and he was like, go over to twitch.tv, and I'm like, what is that? And then I went over there that day, and I was in there, and I was like, wait a minute, I thought this was a gaming streaming platform, and this guy's like painting, and he's painting like creatures, and I'm like, whoa, that's what I do. And so I sat around after that, and then one big thing happened. I don't know if you're familiar with Twitch, but they have these things called raids,
yeah.
Right? Where the stream before raids you, right? And Bob Ross, he's not alive anymore, but he's one of the biggest art streamers on Twitch, and he raided this guy with like 4,000 people, and I was like sitting there, what is going on? And all these people come in, and so basically what happened after that, the guy saw me, and I made my name I Paint Creatures, because I had that brand already going. That was my name on Twitch when I signed in. And the guy, the streamer, after the crowd kind of died down, he's like, hey man, I love your name, let's see your creatures, dude. And I was like, well, I just started an Instagram, so I'm like, oh, go bop over there. And he came back from Instagram, and he's like, dude, where'd you come from? I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, dude, you're, like, badass. And I'm like, well, you know, I told him I work at Lucas. He's like, you work at Lucas? Oh, my God. And so then basically a whole bunch of them in that stream that night were like, dude, you need to stream. We want to see you do this stuff. And so basically I created a stream called I Paint Creatures, and then that blew up, and I actually got partnered at Twitch. It was really hard, I guess, for an artist to do that. And then at one point, you know, I had enough work, you know, professional artists. So at one point I was like, I'm making money off these subs and donations, all this, but and commissions. I started getting commissions. I was like, I need to make a product. Will you guys support a product? Okay, I need to do like a crowdsource. And so they basically said, make a book. And I was like, same thing, kind of like Clubhouse. I was like, make a book? I'm ready to make a full feature film, man. Screw this book. And they're like, yeah, but make a book. And they started throwing money at me right then. So I was like, okay, I'm making a book. And so I made this book. And then basically one night, I basically published the book, my whole self and everything. And it's a 90-page book of, like, all my sketches, paintings, and drawings. And basically I'm a visual storyteller, so I just don't do random creatures. I'm telling the whole story all the time. Just in my poetry integrates with that, too. And so one night when I was actually working on the book, I needed a break. So I went to my sketchbook, and I just kind of, I don't know, I was like, I don't really want to draw creatures right now. Maybe I'll just do some portraits. And so I just, like, started, oh, man, let's do portraits of creature storytellers. And so I just started doing these rough sketches. I did Dr. Seuss. I did Morris Sendak. I drew Kira Kurosawa. I drew Joseph Campbell. I drew Shigeru Mizuki, who's the grandfather of manga. And then I drew Shel Silverstein, and I drew Jim Henson. And then the next morning, when I woke up, I looked at the page, and I'm like, wait a minute. Every single one of these guys is dead. I was like, whoa, this is weird. And so I ended up showing it to my stream, and then I wrote a poem to explain it. And then that's basically at one point in the stream, I was showing it all. And then I started looking down the chat, and they all started saying, man, you're the next Dr. Seuss, dude. You're like the Japanese Dr. Seuss. And then one guy ringed in, and he goes, you're like a lot of those guys, but out of all those guys you're showing us, you're Jim Henson. And I was like, well, what? And then I realized the whole thing Jim Henson did, right? He picked puppets because, you know, to do animation, you got to bring in a team. You know what I mean? It's getting easier, right? And I have all kinds of methods to do animation, but it's over your head because, like, try to do a feature film and compete with Disney and Pixar, you know, it's like, oh, man. And then later that week, a lady bopped in my stream, and she said, I heard all about that dialogue with that guy, all about Jim Henson, and I'm a seamstress. And she goes, wouldn't it be so cool to take some of your creatures and make puppets? And I was like, whoa, really? And so she made two puppets, and then so that was like 3 years ago, right? Almost 4 years ago, and so I attempted to do it on Twitch to get the voice actors and get everyone, but Twitch is just a whole different beast than Clubhouse. And so then when I got on Clubhouse, I was like, whoa. I started reading people's bios, and like everyone and their mother is a voice over actor or a motivational speaker. And I'm like, whoa,
right.
And poets. So I just
right.
like, I just threw, I actually went into some other houses first and proposed it to them because they were already populated. I was like, man, let's make a show in here and let's do audio theater. And they're all like down, but they could never get their shit together. So basically what happened is, I opened my own club, and one day I was trying to bring in those other clubs and go, here's the club where we could work out. And then it all fell apart. So at one point I was just, to keep things going, I just started throwing my characters in there and my story, Matsu. And then one day I just opened the club, and I'm like, I don't know what to name it. I'm just going to just open auditions for Matsu and the Funky Eye Puppet. And
wow.
Mark, that's the end of the story. They flooded me.
I can believe
now
it.
I'm getting the story, now I'm getting the stories of them, Mark, and they're telling these amazing spiritual stories of how they landed in there, every single one of them. So it's really meant to be. You know, it's really working in faith, for sure.
Oh, no, and a lot of things work in fate. Like I said, I'm definitely, like we were talking about in that room yesterday, I'm a believer in fate and that we're in the middle of a new renaissance and the fact that a lot of us are connecting on, like, a level that I've never seen us connect before. I actually felt this way about even before COVID because I thought that there was a beginning of a renaissance as early as 10, 15 years ago, maybe around 9/11. But definitely I think that this is the kind of the epitome of it and what's going to come out of this is going to be tremendous. And I think that one of your projects is – and several of your projects. I don't think that it's just one project. I actually think it's several projects are going to be truly breathtaking and all of that. I was wondering if you were talking about the different styles, because you talk about like the classical cartoonists like Charles Schulz and, of course, The Simpsons. But I have always been a fan. It doesn't always show in Clubhouse, but I've always been a fan of satire. So I was wondering, is any of your work, even in the puppetry field, has ever dealt with that? Because I've seen puppets, like I mentioned, in Clubhouse being used to talk about issues like mentioned the group that's here in North Carolina, the Paper Hand Puppet Intervention, and they do a lot of environmental things. And I'm a fan of Bloom County, which was very political, and Doonesbury. But I was just wondering, did any of your work touch on any of that?
Basically, the story of Matsu is all of it. Basically, the Funky Eye Puppets is like if the Simpsons met Fat Albert and met Calvin and Hobbes, and met The Simpsons and met Adventure Time and like Doonesbury, and I'm a huge fan of Gary Larson and The Far Side.
Right.
And basically, you know, anything creatures, you know. And there's tons of satire because I specialize in yokai creatures, which are, you know, I mentioned before, are Japanese folklore creatures. And so all the satire and humor comes because these are yokai, roughly in English, means strange spirit. And so there's all the satire comes out of the Funky Eye Puppies because they don't need to eat and they don't need to sleep. So anytime we throw in a real world scenario, it's hilarious what starts to happen.
I can believe that because when you were saying, even though we do sometimes get into that weeds of politics, when you were saying monsters and creatures, I was thinking about and George Lucas's definition of there being a difference between monsters and creatures. I was thinking, oh, so that actually explains Mr. Trump. So he was actually the ones that are the negative ones, the truly negative ones, whereas the other ones are the ones that were dealing with him in life and everything. Because when you were describing George Lucas's definition, I was like, oh, so that explains a lot about that craziness that was going on 4 years or so.
Yeah, even the contrast in Star Wars, right? Because you have, I forget the big worm creature, Jabba the Hutt.
Right, Jabba the Hutt.
He's a monster. He's a creature, and then his whole background is all like a lot of monsters in our human world, right? He had a hurt childhood, right? And then there's Yoda, you know, and Yoda's not a monster. He's a creature, right? He's a sorcerer, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You could even use that same kind of kind of concept, because I was also a fan not just of Star Wars but of Star Trek. So I guess you could use that same kind of concept if you think about like the Datas of the world versus the Borgs of the world, because one would probably be a monster, whereas Data would be more of a creature.
And then there's that whole hero's journey, right? The transformation too of like the Borg, right? Like especially in I forget what Star Trek one where they take that Borg, actually she goes back to being a human again.
Right. I think that was Seven of Nine or one of those characters that developed more of those human kind of qualities.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm a huge Gene Roddenberry fan, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm definitely a fan of Gene Roddenberry. And it's really interesting. We're seeing more of this kind of science fiction view out there now. We're seeing more people that are getting into science fiction. Of course, we're seeing these millionaires going on these millionaire trips. I know we sometimes joke even on this show about the fact that it sounds good, but I do sometimes worry when we're seeing millionaires taking what looks like basically joyrides, because we're going not even all the way into space, but just above the atmosphere, and then you're coming right back down. And I'm like, you know, I've never had that pleasure of getting in the car, because I'm not a driver in society. I'm one of those mass transit people because of some things in my own life having to deal with dysgraphia and other things. Dysgraphia is a form of kind of similar to dyslexia. So most of my life I've been without car, but I'm still going. So I never had that experience of a joyride. But I know what a joyride is. My brother definitely has had some interesting travels with cars, sometimes with me in them. So I know what the concept is, but I'm going like, wait a minute. That being said, to go all the way up in space just to come all the way back down didn't really make a lot of sense to me. But, hey, I guess if you got that kind of money, you could do what you feel like doing with it. And to us, it would be like almost a dollar or a quarter. But to them, it would be our equivalent of a dollar or a quarter. But to them, it's nothing because it's $100 million or whatever it was that they put to go in that space trip. But it's one that's been in that world because you worked at Microsoft. Were you like, did you have that kind of visceral reaction as well, where you're sitting there going like, why are they going up in space and why are they like spending all that money to go basically on a grand joyride?
Yeah. And then what's really interesting with the Funky Eye Puppets, right, I was really resonating last night in the Field of Dreams where you were talking about the Renaissance and the shift on the planet. Well, just in this last month, the Funky Eye Puppets took an amazing turn, and I have 5 disabled people on the cast. And they're all very conscious about their, like, one has multiple sclerosis, and then Troy, you met last night, he's a blind cello player.
Wow.
And we have a HIV positive and a quadriplegic now on it, and 2 other beings who had one that was shot in the head with a gun, and so she's fully brain damage recovery, and then another person that also had brain damage and basically died and came back. And so it's the whole metaphor of clubhouses save their life. Because now they can be, you know, superpower, I call them superheroes because their voice. And they did it all through their voice. So we're looking at maybe even taking a sidebar to, because I was producing a Funky Eye Puppet feature film. But now I'm thinking I'd rather put the troupe together and even get on Zoom right now and Zoom into children's hospitals.
Wow. So you can actually get it in.
And all the creatures are also, we're incorporating superpowers, like for the quadriplegic, right? The one who got shot in the head, she's in a wheelchair, right? And her creature is called Propeller. And is a little water goblin creature. And the water goblin basically can create swells of water anywhere and surf them. So
that's amazing.
Next level walking, right? Yeah.
That's truly amazing. I can definitely see that.
Yeah.
I definitely want to hear more about even your views about minority participation in STEM and things of that nature. But before we get to that, I want to hear a IPC poem. You know, I never can have you anywhere without hearing one of them long IPC poems. So can we have a demonstration of some of your poetic skills, and then we'll come back and maybe on the other side after a musical break talk a little bit about your views on science and where we are as minorities in terms of being recruited into that field. But I'd love to hear one of those amazing IPC poems, if I can ask for one of those.
Sure. I was walking these clubhouse streets where the audio sounded so sweet, and who would I meet? This cat named Mark Lee. And I was blessed to meet because, hallelujah, I say I was happening. With the delicious words of prayer, I entered my faith because this is how I create. You see, the universe of truth is all right inside, and it tells us that we have all arrived to make the connections. We all live in this red river, and I shouted the moon, and I swallowed a song, and out of it came a lunar tune from within, and I swang on the crescent. And I'm now talking in this radio space, this podcast with my friend Mark Lee. But today my city is lonely. It's filled with noise feeding back the crowds of worry and self-doubt, and I want to welcome back in my wonder. The awe of being a poet, being alive, my love of language that is a compass that composes skylines that can be spoken like desert rain, broken stanzas, rodeo courtships, where I can gallop into the desert dust of this matrimony unknown, ocean sailing the mystery of my emotions, and be a creature again. Express this bountiful blood river music inside my congested rippled tuba, release its notes of living, because this life is music. I can hear the percussive fresh air from a polluted orchestra pit, and I want to unleash a symphony of words, phrases caged in wildness, formed into a key that unlocks and opens these doors inside my flesh I never knew was shut. Because we all have lighthouses in our chest, arrangements of verbs and nouns that become a vehicle of land and sky and its buoyancy of salt water, spoken song written to express. When I'm standing at the checkout counter, sometimes us artists think we were here just to be something, to encounter something, but we have to buy months of groceries. And I'm here on the planet to tell you a poem can arrange all the cashier lines. It can even do the laundry for you. It can let the dog out when you're dreaming in sonnets and couplets and iambic meter maids and haiku that shows me what I made, supernatural parking and ink that won't fade. It's a Super Bowl of linebackers, these poets that won't abandon the grand expression, this courtship depression, especially from the bull city. It takes away all this anxiety, disease, and undigested emotion. And it makes me want to compose my originality, the unique way my bruised eyes of window pane, the sorrow and suffering of this world, and the expression that is flayed of gourmet, and I season my words I've harvested from bouquets of this language, and I can taste it with sake, October beer, fresh cilantro, and sizzling metaphors. I can hear the big band music and new horns of a newborn crying. I can touch the cool, crisp mornings, air in Antarctica to the rough cedar barks of Lebanon, to the soft shadows of acacia trees in the African tundra, the softness of Tokyo's lost lotus petals, a song I can hear in the orchestra pit of my hippo's gut, a poem I can feel when a human has given up. It's a greeting that I haven't heard before. It's one of those birthday wishes in the freshness of a New Year celebration. It's a poem I can feel like tequila rolling into my insides, because I gotta feel that poem, relate to it like it's family and homesteads, because they're just cranial wall bangers healing my confused, worrisome head. If it be silk or satin or cold steel, splintered, broken bones, to the soft lips of the lover's rose petals, a poem that makes rain roll from my eyes, a poem that through all the seriousness with laughter that breaks barriers and dances and sings and lets out a cry, a poem full of California grizzly courage, feet without shoes, where I can feel the bareness of this earth, a poem that is smarter than the average bear, a poem that stands by us all, and it plays the music of the cracked Liberty Bell, a poem for all my people, so I can greet everyone from this podcast, and I can greet them universally, and I can say hello, konnichiwa, hola, namaste, ni hao, yatehe, enle. My name is Human, and I am a poet.
Wow, I love your work every time I hear it, whether it's in Clubhouse or even now right here on Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. I am a fan of IPC, and like I said, I know that I've heard that voice before, even at Haiti and other places, but I've been a fan ever since the time of actually seeing it in person, but even here in this radio space, I am definitely a true fan, and I know that definitely Dasan, when he catches this on replay, and definitely some of the other friends that are part of our circle, they'll be representing and definitely remembering their great times with you as well. And definitely I know that you picked up some new fans, including Dean and others that will be checking it out as well. But IPC, I said I was going to ask you about this whole concept of STEAM and science. And do you feel that we're getting enough representation of us in, and when I say us, I mean minorities, within the creative space? Because like I said, I definitely feel that new renaissance, like I was talking about, in that Field of Dreams room. But I do sometimes worry about there not being enough gatekeepers. Like I said, I know you're in California. My friend Ronnie, who's originally from Hillsborough and did that film This Christmas, is there in California. And to some degree, y'all are gatekeepers and have worked with some amazing folks. But I don't know if there's enough of us. And I would argue the same thing for our lady peers as well. But I was just wondering your thoughts about that, and if you feel there's enough of that kind of true representation going on, whether it's Asian or whether it's African American or whether it's Hispanic or the various other minority cultures that are out there.
I think there is good representation, but I think there's a lack of perception and the rooted knowledge and the history of that we're in there. For instance, grew up with an older brother, so my first exposure to a lot of my music was like classic rock and roll, right? And I always remember, I never saw a Japanese guy up front, doing the vocals and singing, and then always kind of like, fueled a lot of my art and always representing my Japanese culture and a lot of that. And then I guess it went to the higher level because one day I was watching a Van Halen documentary, and they showed their mom, and their mom was a little Asian lady. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And it rewinded back, and so it totally made sense, right, how, like, Eddie Van Halen was like the ninja of the guitar, played it like Mark, like an Asian. And then I started looking at them, and Alex, his brother, who's the drummer, they all had those kind of slanted eyes. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And so I think my work also, explained a little bit about my master's degree and all that, working with that fantastical lady, professor. And so, I think a lot of mine goes into the creature world. That's why I'm so into doing creatures, because like how you referenced before, how there's a renaissance and a shift on the planet. I think that's the next level of really getting in, so we can all see ourselves as human and forget about all these race issues, because I think it definitely, I'm on your side, we're very unrepresented, and I think a lot of it is in perception too, because I'm a dark-skinned Asian Japanese who's lost a lot of my heritage, and so I identify with the Ainu, which are the native Japanese, the Indians of Japan. And because I live in a college town, so I'll meet a lot of exchange students, right? And their skin is very, very pale, and I'm pretty much a dark-skinned brother, and so they usually think I'm Native American or Mexican.
Well,
so, definitely.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And a lot of times people's perception of us is also very interesting. Being a light-skinned African-American, I can tell you that I've been confused for all kinds of folks. I've been having spaces where people have said, particularly when the beard was less gray and maybe in a certain style, they might think that I was Cuban or Hispanic and even compared me to Fidel back in the day. And then there were other folks that had different things as well. And then I've had some strangers, like European and other things also. So it's always fascinating.
Yeah, and so the creature work, and this is a latest awareness. That's why I love when you speak on Clubhouse, especially when you take it to the next level of things like your spirit does. And actually, I had a wild experience on Clubhouse because I was in, I don't know if you've ever seen the Diversity in Hollywood room, but basically I'd never been in there, and Consuelo is a mod in there. And so I've always wanted to go in there, and I wandered in there one night, and they were all arguing. Wow. It was like a diversity. Yeah, and you know, a lot of it was African-American folks because they were feeling offended. And so you guys are so powerful. They all grouped together, and they were, like, battling the Arab and the Indian folk. And I was sitting in there, and I was just like, man, I don't know if you want me to speak, you know, because, you know, talking about genocides and stuff, the latest one in our history is the Japanese-American internment camps. And that's pretty much buried. Kids don't even know what that is, man. And I bring it up, right? And so basically my point, you know, I was in there and I was like getting sick to the stomach. It was the first room on Clubhouse. I had to leave. It was just getting too much. They were like crazy, and it was just like crazy. But then when I left, I go to my poetry. I got to write this out. I got to figure it out. And then I started realizing that's where the Funky Eye Puppets, I'm actually delivering what they were all arguing about. Like the cast, I have 40 people in my cast, and they're pretty much, I think I got every race on Clubhouse. Plus the disabled people. So it's at a whole nother level. Kinds of issues like that, because I assign, they're all Japanese quote unquote folklore creatures, right? But I don't have my language, and basically, you know, I was raised in California, so I'm Japanese American. And so, like, there became things where, like, there's a African American lady, and I just assigned these creatures random because I didn't even know what I was doing. So I just followed my intuition, and I assigned them to what's called a Kappa water goblin. And it's a creature that's like part turtle, part duck, part, you know, all the water animals, fish, and all this, but it's also a human. That's why it's a goblin, right? And she was all like, what are these things? You know, and at one point she called me up, and she's like, so can you define if it's male or female? I just kind of want to know what's going on. I'm like, well, I think that's what's magical about these creatures. I want you guys to define, is it a female or male? What kind of energy is it? And then she's like, well, what's the history of these goblins? And I told her a little bit, and I told her how I reinterpret them. I don't use like Wikipedia and all that. I go back to being an ancient poet and storyteller, and I use them as symbolic creatures to tell this humane story. And she was all like, well, that sounds great. So can I call it like an African kappa? And I was like, yeah, you could do that. But you know, where I'm working, I want to go to the next step. Let's redefine all this. And she was like, well, I even like that better. You know, let's call it a kappa and, like, let's define, you know, it's not a race and it's not a gender. You know, just like, and then she brought up, like, Tweety Bird, right? Everyone loves Tweety Bird, but no one knows really if it's a dude or a chick, right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. You said that. Everybody has their own spirit animals, because even my dad, I was talking about him being an artist, and I know that as far as I'm concerned, his spirit animal, and I don't even know when he developed his spirit animal, but you're talking about turtles, and he's always been, at least for the last several decades, a fan of turtles. I mean, he's been overseas and, you know, basically brought a turtle from overseas back to the United States where he lived with him, and he had a big-time land tortoise, which had the weirdest name of all, because the land tortoise's name was Buttercup, and he kept Buttercup before it passed away back in a doghouse in the backyard and everything. It was this lady giant big turtle that he was very much bonded with. I think if I had to personally say the animals that Dad most strongly bonded with, it was probably Buttercup and Coffee, which was his lab retriever, that and unfortunately both of those have passed. But he still has multiple turtles in the house. I think there's a couple of turtles in his backyard pool area, and there's definitely a few still in the house and everything. But every time I turn around, turtles seem to be his animal that is the one that he's attracted to, just like my brother seems to be attracted to dogs, and I think he's got a snake or two, but definitely attracted to dogs. And for me, cats seem to be the animals that pull me in along with rabbits sometimes. But it does fascinating how we all have, whether we have the native heritage or the Asian heritage, this concept with animals and they're even being spirit animals. But that's just my thoughts. I'd love to hear if you agree with me that we all have some sort of spirit animal guides.
Well, that definitely taps into, you know, definitely my whole, I'm right on the same page as you, you know. Yokai are really fascinating, right, because it's just like in the Western world, you pretty much have J.R.R. Tolkien, right, because he created Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and George Martin, the author of Game of Thrones, there's a YouTube video where he talks about why J.R.R. Tolkien is so important in fantastical storytelling, right? Because he was a guy that created a world, not just the stories. He created a whole world and the history of the world and all the races. And that's basically George Martin's. He says that's why Game of Thrones is at the level it is, because he's modeling J.R.R. Tolkien. So if you take the yokai are basically the Japanese or the Eastern version of like J.R.R. Tolkien's world, and how the Japanese create with the yokai is their deities. So they're pretty much spirit animals, right? And but they also move into what's called the Tsutsugami, which we have in the Funky Eye Puppets crew, which are basically Toy Story. So inanimate objects and industrial things could become creatures, right? And they have just the simple mythology of, like, they taking from the human, right? Most of us live to 100 years old. So a Tsutsugami, so like a little teapot that's been there for 100 years turns into a yokai. Because after it turns 100 years old, it gets its spirit, right? So it's the whole metaphor of us, like, dying or whatever, becoming, and then the whole Native American is spirit creatures. And then what's so wild about yokai is they also make them like deities, because a lot of their religion is not so rigid like Christianity, right? So it's Buddhism and Zen and Shinto, right? So it's all more about being present and, you know, not bringing too much ideology into the world of mystery. Just like Joseph Campbell has a great story where he's at a conference and the reporters were all reporting on all the different entities or groups, like the Shinto monks, right? And Western reporter went up to one of the Shinto monks and place. It's so beautiful how you do things and how you do your rituals every day and keep the spirit alive. So what is your ideology? And Joseph Campbell always loved this monk's answer, because the monk said, we don't have no ideology. We just dance. Right? And so, yeah, so the funky eye puppets and the yokai, what's incredible how you're talking about your family, that's what they do. So basically a lot of the yokai are really fun. So like, say the toilet got flushed in the night and no one knows who did it, right? And so the Japanese created yokai out of that, you know. The time we live in and where it's real interesting in my work and a big influence with Lucas, right, is going back and being an original poet and storyteller, not using Wikipedia and this whole internet thing, right? But what's happening with a lot of the yokai, right, remember, all of them weren't created out of an encyclopedia or dictionary. They were created by poets and storytellers telling stories, and they needed symbolic metaphors, just like spirit animals and Native American stories, right? And basically, so a lot of the Wikipedia information is really dangerous to me as a 21st century storyteller, because they're all monsters. They're all demons. Because they used a lot of these creatures and they invented them to talk about rape and incest and murder, right? Because that was the metaphors back then. And so my work is very prevalent, because I'm taking like the Kappa yokai, right? If you go on Wikipedia, there's strange things like they eat, like, you know, sexual parts and blah, 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 and all this. And the major number one myth is they're the reason why children drown in rivers, because there's a Kappa yokai down there, and they go down there and the Kappa, like, drowns them or whatever. But so they're real interesting, because they have this dish on their head, right, that's supposedly filled with water. And so it's either a dish or it's a bowl or something. But as a poet, right, instead of like reading Wikipedia, I just look at all the symbols, like, whoa, okay, this creature is part turtle, so what's the, you know, energy and the meaning behind the turtle, and what does it bring our lives, like spirit animals, right? Well, it's a fish, what does it do? And then it's part human, and the human aspect of a goblin to me, like goblins, you know, if you look it up on a dictionary, it just says some dirty, evil, demonic creature, right? But so in my world, and I kind of took this from Lucas too, a goblin is just a human being that's gone back to their more animal nature. And so they started incorporating. So what you made me think of is the yokai are so amazing, right? Because all the animals that are in Japan, they combine them. The Kappa, right? But tons of them that have dogs, right? And so to me as a poet, I don't look at the dog. I look at loyalty and fierceness. right? And that's the energy I'm putting into my character. And so I invent them all the time. So then the Funky Eye Puppets, there are what I call classic yokai, and so they are the kappa, but I'm also redefining them for the age. And the, basically, in the Funky Eye Puppets, there's a crew called the Kappa DJs, and I modeled those after the Ninja Mutant Turtles. You know, in the story of Matsu, you know, it's a totally evolved tale, and so it's basically a time where there's no war. So, like, if you see a lot of popular cartoon and anime, right, you always see the power creatures, and they're always holding a weapon, right? Some type of destructive thing. And in the story of Matsu and the Funky Eye Puppets, they're all holding all this amazing technology, but it's like it has piano keys on it, or it has a paintbrush out of it, or, you know, they're all, and I call them instruments of mass creation.
I love that. So instruments of mass destruction, instruments of mass creation. And it's interesting you were talking about that, because as you were saying that, I was thinking about all these. And I know that one of the people in the clubhouse room was talking about this yesterday, but these dystopian creatures that are dystopian stories that are looking at a new world that's positive in some ways, but it's fantastical, because I am a fan of Black Panther and that whole Wakanda image. But you can say the same thing out of the feminist movement with, like, the whole Wonder Woman Xena narrative as well. And then even I know that the young lady was talking about that she didn't see enough of that in the LGBT community, even though I think that I have seen a few as I was judging films, but they haven't had maybe the success of, say, a Wakanda or a Xena or a Wonder Woman. But it's just interesting how we're using these fantastical stories in order to paint the world that we want out there, because that's definitely what Wakanda was, and it's definitely in my mind what Wonder Woman and Xena were about, even though they were set in ancient times.
Yeah, and I'm really influenced by, like, you're a Trekkie. I'm really influenced by Gene Roddenberry, and then, of course, his roots, which is Isaac Asimov, right, the real science fiction writers, and the whole concept of, you know, what you were talking about is representing the new world. And Matsu, which is the main story, right, which also has an acronym. It stands for Making Art Together, Supporting Unity. And so that's kind of the basis of the story. And another thing I've done, which I haven't met anyone on the planet yet who's doing it, is the whole history of Matsu, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Tales of Narnia, Ninja Mutant Turtles, you know, Far Side. It's all the imaginative stories that have come before it is the history of my Matsu world.
So it's basically like a history. It's like going through a history narrative while you're going through the story narrative as well. I know that one of the shows that a friend of mine does, and it's on the live stream platform, is one called The Gamer's Den. But Jatobi comes out of that video game world. But as you were describing it, I was seeing these puppets that they could also be entire video games, if not entire animations and movies, because as you were describing them, I was like, these things seem almost destined to be not just one form of creativity, but multiple forms of creativity. I know that there are people in that video game space, in Clubhouse, in Discord, in a number of these other kinds of rooms, but as you were describing, I was going, this could be like a whole other Lucas empire.
Yeah, well, the first project I worked on, George Lucas, right, he had a major question in his head. And that's one of the reasons he hired me. He was like, how come in all the schools, just in the United States, there's not one of him graduating high school each year? And not necessarily a filmmaker, just someone who's going to shift the whole planet with their purpose, you know? And so the first project I worked on, he introduced me to two concepts. One was multi-platform storytelling, because he was watching the internet and he was like, wait a minute, the future of filmmaking, we ain't going to have to use McDonald's or Taco Bell to advertise it. We can use YouTube and we can just tell all kinds of stories because the Star Wars universe is, you know, endless. And so he was all like, whoa, what if we did that? And then he was also interested, how could we incorporate that so we can find that stoner kid or that rebel kid that was like me and just can't pay attention to science and geography because it has no relevance to their street life and how they're already adult because of their home circumstances. And he wanted to bring in, how do we bring in Star Wars to teach physics? Then he started getting flack from the society, right, because they were all like, because he was he had running the division called Lucas Learning at that point. And that's where he majorly brought me in to, like, how do we start making products that could tie Star Wars, because all the kids love Star Wars, but then tie in how they can make a living. You know, maybe they have a talent in geography or science or physics or something. And he was taking a lot of slack from the society because they're like, you're just trying to sell Star Wars. And so the last project before I left there, we formed the, what is known as GLEF, which is the George Lucas Educational Foundation.
Oh, well. I didn't know George had an educational foundation, and that's fascinating because, yeah, and that's a great question he was asking, because it should be at least one society shifter, or if you want to use science fiction terms, shape shifter that comes out of every school system of the country, or yeah, definitely every state, if not every school system. So it seems to me with every school has, you know, thousands of students, there ought to be at least one that has got those kind of mind-changing views. And it seems to me that he wasn't even finding that. It was like he was finding like maybe one out of every 100,000 schools or out of every million schools. And that is really way underrepresented from what we need. Cause, and the other thing that I find fascinating, I love your thoughts because you grew up in that kind of environment, is that some of the skills that we need, they're already being developed. Because I grew up in Durham, but I also grew up in a rural town. I have friends that grew up in urban environments, including some that would have grown up in what people would have considered gang drug culture. And I can tell you that some of the business skills and some of the creative skills that they needed were already being developed and being cultivated by those cultures, but they weren't being cultivated into the mainstream society. And that's why they get caught into the prison system and that whole prison industrial complex. But that's my whole thing, is how many, speaking of what we were in that room of yesterday, the field of dreams, I wonder how many true field of dreams are actually sitting in our prison systems and aren't getting the encouragement. Don't get me wrong, I know that Dasan, probably you there in California, have been into the prison systems, but are they getting enough support, talent, but are they getting enough support from the administration and the people as they even try to get out into society? And that's where my concern is I know there are programs where people like you and Dasan and Church and others go into prisons, but it's one thing to reach out there and talk to them. It's another thing for them to have encouragement to use those business skills and those creative skills that they might have developed in the gangs, or they might have developed even enhanced furtherly in the prison, and then we bring them out and throw them back into the back to the wolves, for lack of a better analogy.
Yeah, well, this is kind of shocking to people, but it always comes up. But if I look back, my first spoken word piece was between two Glocks. Between two guns.
The Glocks.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, basically two Asian street gangs, and I was kind of an elder at that point because I was a supplier. And basically they were about to have a whole shoot down, and I stepped right in between, and I spoke for like 35 minutes straight. And then they put down the guns. So to this day, I don't even know really what I said, but I said something. And so when I look back, that was probably my first performance.
Well, that was a serious performance. So if I'm hearing you correctly, at some young age, let's say your 20s or whatever, you were in the middle of a gang confrontation, and and you spoke some poetry that basically, even though you might have had a role as in that as well, being a supplier or whatever, but you spoke some poetry that got both of them to lay down their weapons.
Yeah.
Wow, that is truly deep that you were able to pull that off, because I'm sure some people were going like, I can't even believe that he's attempting to try to talk these people down. Because I know that one of the scariest moments that I've
Exactly. I think back to that moment, and I don't even know, I think it was the spirit. I don't even know why I was even in there. But I just remember when I started getting into Poetry Slam, I just kept going back there, just going, whoa.
No, it's interesting that you say that.
Kind of stupid.
Yeah, it's interesting. No, but it's interesting that you say that, because I remember Well, I was not having that kind of environment. I've always been a networker, a connector. That's always been kind of one of my roles in life and everything, and still a role that I enjoy, along with being a definitely using my media and event planning and other spaces to help enhance society in any ways that I can. But my brother actually works with at-risk youth. He still does work with that to this day with his company that he's got. And I remember we were sharing an apartment. It was actually an apartment that my not an apartment, it was a house, but a house that my mom helped us buy because, you know, she was – she knew that Dad was tired of us living with him, and she didn't want us being too far away, and she didn't feel we were ready to be out into the world yet. So she basically bought a house, and it was actually not that far from Dad, literally around the corner. And it was known as the party house. And Malik was young, and he was having parties, and I was not minding the parties, even though I was a little bit older, 7 years older than he is and everything, but I was enjoying some of the party atmosphere. And but I remember one time there was somebody that stepped bad to him and his crew and everything. All I remember from that memory is kind of like what your memory is of the poetry, because all I remember is I didn't even know that this crew had that many weapons, and all of a sudden weapons started popping out of nowhere, and I'm going as the naive older person, like, where the heck did this stuff come from? Because he wasn't even aware that people were, you know, in that life force packing or even doing safety things. Because, like I said, all I knew is somebody had come into the party, tried to disrupt it, and, you know, they pull out their thing, and about 20 other things come out. And I'm going, like, I'm just sitting there in a fantastical moment going, like, where the heck have y'all been hiding this at?
Yeah.
So it's just fascinating how sometimes these things just pop up out of nowhere and shock you, even if you're not, whether you're involved in it like you were or whether you're a spectator as I was. It's just sometimes amazing how those things will shock you. But like I said, it's probably part of my brother's destiny, because he's been very much in that space of trying to make sure that kids get out of that space now. So he does a lot of work working with the kids to make sure that they're not following into that lifestyle or things of that nature. But I'm always fascinated by the business skills that so many have in that space, because I've definitely got some friends that are working in that space. And they are, I mean, we talk about the Elon Musk and the Jeff Bezos of the world, but in terms of true economic business skills, I think that some of those have just as much as some of our corporate leaders. They may not have as much product, and they may not have as much distribution sites that they're able to make that kind of just basal kind of money, particularly if they're coming out of our neighborhoods. But the business skills that they have, I just wish that they would turn them to something what society considers more mainstream.
Well, that's what's real interesting. We're so much in alignment, me and you, because that's the whole reason I'm doing the Funky Eye Puppets and Matsu, is of course to, you know, live out my film destiny and things like that, but it all is basically what Matsu is, because the concept George gave me was multi-platform storytelling and interactive storytelling, and so I've taken that to a whole nother level. Like the story of Matsu is designed to continue after I'm gone, and after all this crew right now, it has a whole component, especially when the money starts to roll in, to give it back to. And I have a vision of these things that I call life houses. And what life house is, it's a three-story building, and on the first floor is a performance space and a workshop area, so a nice little theater. And then the second floor is a high-tech, creative, internet, traditional and digital art studio, and a internet broadcast studio. And then the third floor is a library that's curated by the artists who teach in the Life House, and then the students who come through. And then the whole model is to build two Life House prototypes, and I'm also looking right now, because of the pandemic, to maybe build them online or start the whole metaphor. And I think it's already kind of happening with the Funky Eye Puppets, because a lot of the Funky Eye Puppets are parents, and some of them are teachers, some of them work with youth, right? And so the model is to basically get and I learned this from the Poetry Slam world, because I also, like Dasan, I became a coach of all the youth poets for many years. And so basically the model is to get 10 students, right, from 13 years old to 18 years old, and basically making a kind of after school program where they come to the center and basically they get schooled in all the arts, not specifically to become a painter or a poet or a filmmaker, but to basically be an entrepreneur and learn how their purpose and their mission and whatever they've come to be alive is their mission. And so basically train them all. Of course, the number one skill is the art of the public speaking or spoken word or poetry, whatever you want to call it. And then tap into all their other interests and their backgrounds from their family and their heritage. And then go on summer tours and go to all the cities and first do a performance for all the kids and the youth and the social workers, right? And then have a fully loaded merch table where they've all produced their own books, their own movies, their own music, all that. And then the workshops will follow those in all about showing them how they all use the internet like we came together, you know. And so that's the whole goal. And the whole goal is so it goes on way after I'm gone. And part of it is marrying, you know, that you can go make money with this. That's why the puppets and the Matsu movie is so important, because I want to show the kids and youth behind us that I'm not playing. You know, you can become a millionaire at this, but you're not becoming a millionaire to ruin your life with money. You're doing it so you can do your art at the highest level possible and in an entrepreneur state.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because it actually resonates on a couple of levels. One, I've actually talked about that even here in North Carolina, because I know that there was a gentleman that had the film lot. He had the old dealer rented studio, and right now it's sitting there empty, and that's the studio that Fazer Blackwell had created over there in Yanceyville, North Carolina. But that thing is sitting empty. I think maybe there's some churches and others that are using it, but it had like an old plantation house, a lakefront, and the last time I heard, I think Dolly Parton and some of her crew were trying, or maybe it was Tweety, were trying to get a hold of it and turn it into something, but it was still sitting there empty at everything, and it's, you know, just not that far from the North Carolina area, because it's in Caswell. I mean, it is in North Carolina, but in Caswell County, about maybe two or three counties from Durham County. But I'm sitting there going, like, this is just some tremendous property that is not being used. And I know that Ronnie, who's the filmmaker that I've referenced a couple of times, who lives there in California and did this Christmas, he's been talking about wanting to come back here to North Carolina, but also doing some stuff in California that would be what you're talking about. It's kind of that educational aspect, because he's been in that film game for 20, 25 years. It created not just this Christmas, but Puff Puff Pass and a couple of other films that he's done with Kai Pfeiffer and a number of other folks. So he's definitely been trying to figure out that next generation kind of conversation, because he's you know, getting up in age as well, not as old as I am, in the late 50s, but I won't say he's early 50s or somewhere around there, and definitely has adult kids. So he definitely would at least one adult kid. So he definitely wants to leave them a legacy, whether that's them pursuing his career or just the legacy of passing on it to another generation. It doesn't have to be his own kid, but I can definitely agree with that. So as you were saying that, I was going like, wow, I've heard this from a lot of folks. I'm hearing it from you now, having heard it from Dasan, having heard it from Ronnie. That's what I mean when I said that era of Renaissance is truly out there. So we're hearing a lot of that elder leadership that is definitely trying to take it to the next level, and also learning from the elders that have gone ahead of us. Because I was friends with, and you probably heard the name, if you know the son of Pierce Freelon, but his dad, Phil Freelon, was the leading black architect over there at the Negro, the Black History Museum up there in D.C. Phil was one of the main creators of that, along with the ballpark here. But I was also friends with Baba Chuck Davis before he passed. You know, he was all about leaving legacies as well. So even reflecting on those that have passed ahead, but also trying to make sure that we are leaving something positive for those after we complete the journey of our life. Even though, like I said, in the clubhouse, and I've said it to other people, I'm personally going for 200, but nobody else is better. So I just figured I'd set an impossible goal. So I'm personally going for 200.
Yeah. Well, you made me think about, because I spent a lot of time in Winston-Salem, right? And when I first went there, I just wasn't awake to, like, what was really going on. But then I spent some summer stints in there because I have a good friend. I don't know if you know Bob Moyer.
Yeah, I've heard the name. I don't know him that well, but I think my friend Calvin Anderson knows him very well.
yeah, he runs the Winston-Salem Slam, and he's really into haiku. But anyway, I got to stay with him, right? And then I started to wake up to Winston-Salem. I was like, wait a minute, name Winston-Salem. Wait a minute, Tobacco Road. Whoa, plantations. I started going, whoa. And so I went out to that guy. I think you know I'm talking about that main tobacco tycoon guy's house that's out there. I think
R.J. Reynolds.
Yeah, R.J. Reynolds. And I went and I spent the whole day crying because I read all about his kids and how they became heroin addicts. And then I toured that building, you know, where he has a swimming pool and the racetrack. And I just literally, like, cried, like, the whole day just going, man, see, money doesn't solve problems, man.
No, money doesn't solve problems. And actually, my mom, who is still living, she actually ran the Golden Leaf Foundation, which is the tobacco settlement money. So she was their first president. I think they're only either their second or their third president. So she actually ran that as their first president for quite a few years, at least a decade, if not a little bit more than a decade. But she was giving money to North Carolina Central, to different people that were doing projects that were getting them out of the tobacco industry, because that's kind of what the whole purpose of the Golden Leaf Foundation was to try to get people out of that industry, but to do more conscious kind of jobs and everything. But she ran that for a number of years and was definitely left her legacy along with the radio station as part of her legacy, even though she's still around and enjoying retirement. But in terms of her work legacy, that is definitely part of her legacy. So I can definitely relate to that. And you're talking about the tobacco people, even here in Durham where I'm at, the Duke family has some very rich history.
Yeah.
If you think about the Duke family, there were Dukes that were in the tobacco field, but they were also kind of doing that, which it goes on. It even goes on over there in the West Coast, that one member of the family might be making all the money and the other member of the family might be a little bit more of a rebel. And so some of the members of the Duke clan might have been spending a little bit more time than was expected in what some people would consider the hood, because I know that there was at least one of those Dukes that was considered a party animal. So he definitely spent some time in the African-American community as part of his partying and maybe even, you know, spreading some joy to some of the sisters around as well. So it would be interesting to find that some of our leadership might have some mixed bloodline based on what some of the Duke Tobacco Harris's and and Hayes were doing. So that's part of the Duke history as well.
I got it. Also,
yeah,
I got awoke into the Hanes too. I was like, whoa, what's up with this Fruit of the Loom? I've always wore the Fruit of the Loom. And then I was like, one day just, whoa, cotton. I was like, oh no. You know, and for the California
think about
kid,
that.
That's a big awakening for a California kid, you know.
I'm sure you probably go like, wait a minute, what did I get into?
Yeah, I was like, whoa, I'm in the heartland of this stuff. You know?
Did your son ever turn you on to the history of Hayti? Because even though I know you came and performed at Hayti, but there were actually, because we just did a Juneteenth celebration a couple of months ago, and one of the people came and broke down some of that history, but there are Arishna symbols that are above the steeple and everything, and there's some interesting theories as to why they are there, but there are definitely some serious Arishna symbols, because there were some people tied to Haiti, to the country of Haiti, that were very much involved in helping put those symbols up. And of course, if you go into the church where you performed at, or the performance hall as we now know it as, if you look on one side, you'll see a picture of Jesus. If you look on the other side, you'll see a picture of one of those Dukes, but that's one of the more straight-laced Dukes, but it's definitely one of the mural glasses. But apparently he gave some money, so when he gave the money, they were putting up those murals in the early part of Hayti's history in the 19th century. And I'm sure he was probably like, yeah, I'll give y'all a couple of you know, what would have been millions to us now, but at that time it was probably tens of thousands, and he was probably like, yeah, all I need in return is for you to put my face on that wall so that people can see it for centuries, and it's been up there on that wall for at least a century.
Yeah, I basically never really been straight schooled by Dasan, but, like, I pretty much kind of mentored him in haiku, and so, like, when he started writing the black themed haiku, that's when he was just blowing me away. And then, you know, that also brings back, you know, figures like Etheridge Knight, you know.
Yep, definitely. I'm familiar with Ezra Knight and all of those great leaders and everything. Who is some of the haiku people that really influenced you and got you into haiku? I know it's a Japanese form, so I'm thinking it's probably something that you learned from your heritage, but are there like some, while you are the all-time champion, how did you personally get involved? Were there some pioneers before? We're talking about pioneers. Were there some pioneers before that drew you into the poetry world and the haiku world, to be specific?
The first thing was what I call the schoolyard format, which is what most people practice, right, which is the five-syllable, seven-syllable, five-syllable, three-line poem about nature that we learned from our fifth-grade teacher, right? And so that was the first place. Right. But then actually where it really came back is when I entered one of my first national poetry slams. Right. I didn't come as a team. I just kind of came in as an individual and brought some friends with me because I kind of the same story about Twitch. I ran into a bunch of poets when I was getting into really doing professional spoken word. Right. And this guy's like, go to the national slam. I'm like, what the hell is that? And so we went there and we were in the hotel room, and one of my friends who I brought with me, he's like looking at the pamphlet. And he's like, dude, they have a side haiku thing, man. And he's like, man. And I was like, well, I used to do that. And then started thinking about, we had this kind of deep talk. He was like, you just don't do it. It's in your blood, man. And then I started going, well, you're kind of right. Because I remember my grandmother always having the scrolls on the wall with the kanji, you know, symbolic Japanese language, and there's only a few symbols on there. And then my grandmother was a Shigin poet, which is the poet of the Royal Court of Japan. So I was like, yeah, okay. So we went in and participated in that, and that's when I won my first title. And what happened in that match is there's the prelims, semis, and the finals, right? And I went through the Trelim, and I just was having fun. I was just gonna fuck them up, basically, like take them to a whole nother level. And I just did that. And then basically, what happened is, then they were like, "All right, you're moving on to the next round." I'm like, "Next round?" I'm like, "I don't have any more. I wrote these this morning, you know, just kind of off the schoolyard format." And so basically then I just sat there in the audience and I started writing them down. And then when we got out on the match and we were competing, I was like, at one point I just felt my blood kind of boiling. I'm like, just set down my notebook and I'm like, let's go. And I just start making them up. Like I start counting the syllables on my finger. You know, I entertained the whole room because I worked in the Japanese tradition of like Zen. You know, I was just talking. All the haikus were about the room and the host and the guest, and you know, and I wasn't really dissing them, but I was like doing it. And then, you know, and then they're like, "All right, you made the semis," and I'm like, "I thought I won." They're like, "No, there's the final round. You and another poet. Best 9 out of 17." I'm like, "Oh no." And so I did the same thing there. I just made them up, and it became like, you know, it went back to hip-hop days. It was a battle. Like, I was just, you know, and what was winning was my presence, not necessarily that they were good written haiku, but I was, like, talking about the presence. And so it was hilarious.
Yes, if you say that, because one of the things that I know when I think of haiku, I think, and even some of the combat poetry that goes on sometimes, is it's very much can be intense battle poetry and everything, and it can definitely be some comparisons to the dozens, which, you know, is historically an African-American thing where you're playing around and insulting each other back and forth. But one of the things that I love whenever you do your poems like you did earlier, and I want you to do one more at the end and everything, is that you always compliment people, and you compliment who's ever in the room. Like if we're in a clubhouse room, you interject people, but it's in a very complimentary fashion. So I think that part of your nature and your gift is that you're able to have these very rich conversations that go on and that are very powerful, but you're uplifting the people as you're talking about them. Because I know every time that I hear you, whether it's me, whether it's Danny, or whether it's some of the other people, you're always putting in their praise and all of that. So it's always fascinating when that takes place and everything. And I'm wondering if this is Dean popping in. So I'm going to see who we've got else there, because I just see we've got another caller that popped in. So I'm going to see if Dean's joining us or what's going on in that sense. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about that, not insulting people, but definitely in praising them when you do your poetry. And, well, I'm glad you're doing Animal Check. Who is this at 330-472-6195?
My name is Dan Guz. I'm an entrepreneur that had gotten in touch with you guys through a channel, and you guys had invited me to call on the show.
Okay, I appreciate it. Definitely, I appreciate you calling in and everything, and we're actually toward the end and everything, but I would love to hear, if you can, briefly, and I would have you definitely call in next weekend, everything, because it's a two-hour show, and it's actually goes to the tail end, but they're having a great conversation with IPC, I Paint Creatures, who is a haiku champion, and it's worked with George Lucas. So really quickly, Dan, if you can tell us about yourself, and I will definitely invite you back, but then I also want to hear from IPC, as he has been having this great conversation about the world of entertainment and the world of poetry, and I'm going to have him do one at the end, and I will definitely have you call back next, well, not next week, because next week is Labor Day, and I got to double-check with Dean to make sure we're doing a show, but if not next week, the week after, but I will follow up with you and figure out whether it's next Monday or the week after, but if you can just at least give an early introduction as to who you are and what you've got going on, and you know that I will be bringing you back.
That's perfect. Yeah, my name is Dan Guz. I founded a company called Lloyd. Last year, we focused on helping young professionals navigate their career, giving them a sense of structure and accountability through what often is kind of a tough and turbulent time for folks a few years after college, trying to figure out, you know, where they want to go in their career and all the decisions that come along with that. So, yeah, we're a technology company that is trying to make a bit of a difference in the world, and excited to, you know, tell folks more about what we're doing.
I appreciate that, and that actually falls into what we were talking about, because definitely IPC has been talking about his company and the puppeteer and the things that he's doing, and a lot of it is about reform and trying to make sure that kids have a future ahead of them as well. So, hey, I didn't even know that George was going to call, even though I probably did invite him, but I didn't know he was going to call on this particular day, and it sounds like he followed right into our Renaissance conversation, IPC, in the sense of he's doing the same thing that we've been talking about this whole time.
Yeah, he's Dan the Man.
He's Dan the Man.
glad I could fit right in. Tell me more about the poetry.
Yeah, please tell him about in an abbreviated version, what's going on with the puppets and the poetry and how this has all been put together and this great, fantastical puppetry group that you're going to have performing, hopefully, out in the real world after we can get past this lovely stuff that's going on called COVID.
So, yeah, I'm basically an award-winning spoken word poet, storyteller. My heritage, I'm full-blooded Japanese, and on one side of the family was the ancient storytellers and poets of Japan called the Shigin poets, and the other side of my family, my father's side, was royal samurai, and I basically have been doing a multidisciplinary artist my whole life, and I got the grand opportunity to work at high-tech firms. I worked with George Lucas personally on his own R&D projects, and then I got to work with the futuristic divisions at Apple and Microsoft. And so I've always been a storyteller, and I've done a lot of street art, and always drawn from my imagination. And so I have a project right now which accumulates it all together, because I realized at one point my name, I Paint Creatures, I'm carrying on the tradition of like Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein and Morris Sendak and Shigeru Mizuki and the great Jim Henson. And so I have a project right now where I'm basically have brought together 40 voice actors on the new social media platform Clubhouse. And I'm putting together basically the next Muppets, but with the I Paint Creatures twist, and they're updated, they're hip, they're into hip-hop, they're into technology, and they're also very much into entrepreneuring, so that's where it enters this space. And then the whole project I'm doing is to do projects like you're doing, Dan, to basically empower the entrepreneurs of the future.
Sounds great, and unfortunately, that's what happens. Is just like in Clubhouse, even in the podcasting world, callers call in, callers drop off, callers call in, callers drop off. So I've just copied down his number, and I will call him back and everything. But we've got about 8 minutes to go, and at the end, we always have to tell people where they can hear the show again, as well as some of the other shows that we have. Because one of the things that I've done, well, actually, Dean did it, and I just kind of helped him along with it, is that I guess technically we both did it, but he came up with the idea of, you know, we've got this podcasting platform on Blog Talk, but we only do our show one day, and he had some other friends that were doing shows, and we were like, why don't we offer it so that other people are doing it, and we're basically creating like a mini network. So I've reached out to my friends that do She's On Call, which is a group of New York medical people, medical women, and their show has allowed to be re-aired on our platform, or we definitely re-aired on the platform. I have another friend that is in the African-American space, and she does a show about going through menopause as an African-American woman. So her show re-airs here. And then there's a family, a young lady and her two young kids that talk about education from their perspective, and their show re-airs. And then Russ Hedge, who is a motivational speaker, and I heard you talk about motivational speakers earlier, he re-airs. And Mona Shakes, who is of Persian descent and from California, her show re-airs on this platform. So there's probably about, I want to say, and that's only five of them, but they're probably close to 12 to 14 shows that Dean goes back in and re-airs. So any of your podcasts that you would like to join or have re-aired on this platform, I'm offering it as an opportunity for it as well. And, of course, I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation in September on the live stream, where we actually get to see each other face-to-face and not voice-to-voice as we do on Clubhouse and as we're now doing on this podcast. But that being said, and with about 6 minutes to go, and I still also have to tell them where it ends. And, by the way, Dean is much better at this part of it than I am. I usually lead the interviews, as you can tell, from both Clubhouse and from this interview space. That's usually my role, is to lead the interviews, but then he comes in, does the sponsorship. He will usually come in and maybe interject some comments and everything, but he's a master at the sponsorship part that I am not a master at. But I'm trying to fill in his shoes today, and I want to say that we said we were not doing next week because of Labor Day. We'll be back in the second Monday of September, which is, today's the 30th, that would be the 13th. So I'm pretty sure we'll be back on the 13th, but I'm going to call him on later on this evening to verify that. But that being said, IPC, can I get a one more of your amazing poems to get us on out of here? And if you could, for Dean, because I know Dean's going to do some of this editing, as he always does, as he puts the shows together and helps us get it out on some of these platforms. So if you could drop in maybe some hip-hop references, because he is a hip-hop head, and the first one did not have any, well, it had maybe some light hip-hop references, but not some total hip-hop references. So I know that's asking for a lot, but can I have a poem with some hip-hop references?
Yeah, I'll kind of throw this one. I just want to kind of take it over to a different realm, because you haven't experienced me doing more storytelling and a kind of a different form of it. And I give a shout out to the Poetry Slam Nation that I was a big part of in the days. And, of course, to all the Bull City poets of G and, Dasan and the whole crew up there. But this is a poem called Lava Pools of Cereal.
Okay, cool.
It was early morning when we still were rubbing the stars from our hip-hop eyes. And it didn't matter if it was cosmic, sunny, or heavy rainfall skies, as long as the cupboards and the refrigerator contained the ingredients, all of us rug rat shorties knew Mama went to the grocery store to stock up on some more Cocoa Puffs and Corn Flakes, Alien Pop, and Yo-Kai Cereal Cakes. It was almost like we took it back to the Wu-Tang Clan, Dr. Dre, and Tupac, but it was those generic 10-pound bags that kept us munching, our doggo tails wagged as our eyes were on a quest listening to Daffy Duck talking jive or Mighty Mouse super creative drive to keep the cartoon universe in order so the Roadrunner would always get across the border by outwitting the coyote with mischief, mayhem, and comedy. To let Bugs take the great Sunday pulpit and that cipher around where give Elmer a sermon about how the Looney Tunes kingdom, no matter anyone's differences, when the credits rolled, we all stood as one nation under African Bambaataa and Kool Herc, and all of the nations under grooves to George Clinton and the Parliament Funkadelic. It was a chuckle or a laugh, adventure of a mouse and a cat that transported us in imaginations on weekends, where Friday night we went to bed early, really didn't sleep as we waited urgently for the first peak of the sun, and then we'd pack up the pillows and color up around everyone around bowls of milky sugar and television rays that began our serial morning cartoon shootout days. If the round bowl spoon helm be served up Captain Crunch or Fruit Loops that worked out even for lunch, or if it was all about leprechauns and our lucky charms on Saturday mornings, we never set our alarms. We always knew if we had a bad week with all-time lows, come Saturday morning, we would be like all Cheerios, floating in lava pools, kicking on the edge of a sofa, old school. But most of the time with fam or best buds, the time to kick it at a parade, arcade, movie time, rodeo, action packs of good old-fashioned fun, where all you needed to know is in between the couch pillows and the nightstand willows, the carpet-colored ruby red was lava fire. So to get to the love seat, you had to aim a little higher than the reclining chair that didn't care if you came crashing on down like an orca with a ginormous grin and a fin that could knock you over into lava beds of red clovers. So most of it just piled up on each other like we were on a mission in a cartoon helicopter, like we were in a cipher around a bonfire and spitting rhymes across the universe. We were scoping out new animated creatures with comedic and supernatural features, adventures, stories, and twisted funny plots. And we grinned ear to ear, and I'm mean a lot. It was a time we knew we could all feel the same as Daffy would show us through entertainment frames that life is just a series of carnival games. And you can choose your flavor in any shape, size, or hue. You can choose Eminem and the hip-hop nation and move us all back to where we find, you know, Malcolm X used to speak right into the words, and Eldridge would sit in his jail cell and write haiku, and that was the beginning of hip-hop because a good friend of mine loves haiku. Her name is Sonia Sanchez, and she knew we could make it on through to continue getting away like the Roadrunner in every possible scenario, the splash and swing low sweet Cheerios, and on any given day we can make it to the Tasmanian Devil Mile, a week of Elmer Fudd trials to exaggerate the winds with a stimpy smile to know strange but heartfelt kids fit in. And Bart said he wants to win within. It's Lisa's ability to use her intelligence to brave the daily battles of Brutus's ignorance, to bring out Bam Bam's innocence and Elroy's intelligence, to Scooby-Doo's curiosity and Shrouder's virtuosity, to Popeye's empowering spinach, to win all of us hearts of damsels and distressed lineage as Snoopy and Albert and the Rascals Gang and Fat Albert, who showed us how to kick it and how to hang through the Saturday news that rang of backroom blues and turned our soggy magic clover flowers into reports on the hour of hostages and the cuts and falls that needed mom's loving care bandages to the Monday morning garbage trucks to the mayhem and the shift-stomping trucks. The living room I grew up in, you see, it only had one small couch and a fireplace. It had a grand piano. It had a few music stands and single window doors where the moonlight did glow, and Saturday mornings were filled with recital tones, the repetition of the music, of the movement, of the poem. And you see, there was no television or barcode boxes, no bowls of spinning cascades, just chromatic meters keeping that constant rhythm laid and the sheets of notes. And the hip-hop music, the funkified way to be, was sugary sweet and was animated in my mind's eye and had me riding my 808 heartbeat. But after my father passed, it was like the music left with him, and our living room became silent, neat, and void of the wild, wild wind. So as the world spins its bowls and platters, kids are growing up in a world void of the Mad Hatter who had remedies the patchwork of what hurts, to the odd shapes of not fitting into all these social networks because their living rooms were not filled with adventurous cartoons. And on the day most adults have weak ends, to the days most of us seem to break and bend, our ability to see beyond our bills due, the insecurities inside me and you that Rocky and Bullwinkle showed us as just a lava rock leap away, as Snoopy and Scooby showed us how to have fun, as they teach us to always be in wonder, to ride like a creature straight into hurricanes of thunder, and to be the earthquake like Rugrats and Doozers when they rump, rattle, and shake, looking at this life like a carnival ride, a Saturday morning cartoon flight beyond the days where the emotions go astray and we regret yesterday's instead of knowing that we're all care bearers and we all have lucky charms. You know, they had less nutrition than harm, those vicious sugar brigades that tried to beat us with hand grenades filled with diabetes. We would always have those memories and then join our living space on a cartoon adventure away from the daily pace into a hyperdrive flight in the beyond. And I will always remember that we didn't need those stinking alarms to rise before the dawn.
Wow. I love that point, but it's interesting you mentioned alarms because I was doing a conference this weekend that missed or got up late for one of the days, still made it in time to start the conference, but it was the alarm and not having the alarm that the person that put that conference went off and got me an alarm. So I'm actually staring at my alarm because they're like, no, we can't have you miss the last 2 days. You need an alarm. And I'm like, no, I'm natural. I don't need alarms. I can get up naturally. And I got up naturally for you and your event. I was just a little bit late, not all the way late because the actual starting time was 8 a.m., not 7:30. So I was technically was still on time, but... It's just interesting how those alarms, I think the ironic thing, IPC, is that the alarm is totally unplugged. Because even though he got it to me and I used it that one next day, I'm not an alarm kind of guy. So that alarm is still sitting there unplugged, and I don't think it's going to get plugged up tonight either because I usually believe in the natural way of waking up and definitely believe that that's the way everybody should wake up, particularly if they're on that creative journey that both you and I are on as part of this new renaissance. So, IPC, I have thoroughly enjoyed our time together. Hope that you can come back. Definitely looking forward to the live stream version in September and everything, and we'll I think we've got that slated for the 3rd September, but I'll send you the link for that. That's more of the audio / visual version, but I thoroughly enjoyed it as I always enjoy your presence, and I know that folks will enjoy catching the reruns, and I am not as good as Dean, as I said, but I know that we're on Spreaker, on Google Play, on definitely TuneIn, and a lot of the other platforms as well, even one out of India. I know it begins with a J, but I can't think of the name, but there are several platforms that are there looking for us. Pretty much all the places that you will find your podcast at, we are being replayed at, including iHeart. So I know that that's a way that a lot of times people will put it. So if they're looking for it and they look for Straight Talk with Dean and Mark, you will find it. And this time it was Straight Talk with IPC and Mark. But we had a great conversation, a thoroughly enjoyable one. I've seen some of the back work that Dean has to do because usually he would be the one screening the calls, and definitely we probably would have brought Dan in still as we did, but hopefully he'll be joining us on the 13th. But I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Look forward to more great conversations. Always enjoy seeing you in the Clubhouse space. And if you've got any last parting shots of words of encouragement, give to the people right now, and then we'll hit the end episode button. But definitely always you give me joy, and I always enjoy being in your presence, whether it's on the phone or whether it's as we are right now in this podcast land.
Yeah, I'd like to leave you with a haiku, but I also like to apologize for swearing. I don't know why I do that because I normally don't swear. I don't know you got it out of me or something in the story, so I apologize. Hopefully they get bleeped out if that was not appropriate. But I'll leave you with a haiku.
Okay.
Anyone tells you you can't fly, stretch arms wide and flip them the bird.
I love that. And no, B and D do not care about a couple of choice words coming out and all of that. So it'll probably still be in the show and everything, but I know that as part of your brand, and if we have to, we'll do that also. But yeah, we've had other people, including maybe even Dasan, that have slipped in some words like that as well. So don't even hesitate to worry about it. And I definitely look forward to catching you in the Clubhouse streets, but also catch you on the live stream sometime in September. Your energy always puts a big smile on my face, and I consider you to be one of my brothers, just like I consider G to be part of my family as well. But I definitely consider you one of my brothers, like I do Dasan and a number of others. So truly enjoyed having you and truly enjoyed our conversation.
Arigato gozaimasu. Thank you very much.
No problem.
All right, bye-bye.
May I have your attention, please? Good evening.
You're listening to Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. We thank you for tuning in.